The following program
under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Oh, and we said our names.
We did it.
We did it.
We did that.
Today, and it's February 17th, 2018. How did that happen?
I'm not sure how we got over halfway through February already. We must be having fun. Hey, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas. And the principals there happen to be the two guys who are on this radio program talking.
Both of us are follically challenged, except for on our faces.
Yes, and both of us have beards, and you can tell us apart, and you've listened very carefully. One of us has a gray beard turning white, and the other one has a dark colored beard.
Yeah, and you can hear the difference on the radio.
Yeah, of course you can if you listen very carefully. And the stuff we talk about, stuff being a technical term, is intended to be educational and not investment advice. It sounds like a picky thing, but bottom line to it is investment advice is information, is also information, but it's advice we give people when we tell them specifically how to invest for themselves that's in the best interest of them. Whereas education is general stuff and may or may not apply to you, this stuff that we talk about. See, it's technical stuff.
And anything we say on here is coming from us, not from Town Square Media or KTEM.
And we receive our information from sources we believe to be reliable. And
close cover before striking unauthorized personnel.
We don't warrant that it's absolutely true or complete, but it's about as close as we know how to figure out how to get it.
We sure try, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Some people say we're very trying.
That's certainly true. So the markets moved around. Well, actually, they didn't move around. They set right where they were this week. However, the numbers on the various indices definitely showed some interesting movement upward. Matter of fact, this is if we look back at this last week, it's one of the better weeks. Dow Jones Industrial Average at 4.25%, the S&P 500 up 4.3%. That sounds really, really cool. And do you realize that
we're still down for
we're still down about 6%
for the year. We're up, but we're up from the top.
So year to date, we're up 2.2% roughly in the broad market. For 1 year, the S&P 500 is up 16.21%, which is a very, very good number, one which I am very comfortable. Why am I comfortable with that? Well, because earnings are coming in from the fourth quarter. It takes us a while to figure out earnings, meaning profits on corporations, which is what ultimately drives the market value over the long term. And good news, if we look at the earnings coming in this quarter from fourth quarter 2017, they're coming in about 78%, 80-some percent now 84, 82, something like percent of changes daily, of them are coming in higher than the estimates. Now, normally, over a long period of time, since the 2000 debacle, 2000 through 2002, about 62% of companies reporting report higher than estimates. Now, when we got something in the 80s, this is pretty much a record. We won't know until the end of the quarter's reporting whether we're actually going to have a record for companies beating estimates. But that's a good sign going forward. The fact that companies during the fourth quarter of last year turned in profits that were greater than were expected on such a consistent basis means that we have an accelerating economy in the corporate profit area. No. And then
can I jump in?
Let me close this out.
All right.
So and profits are up a little over 15% from last year at this time. In other words, fourth quarter 2016 to fourth quarter 2017 so far.
And this is before the tax cuts are right. Finalized.
Right. We're up 50, earnings up 15%, the market's up 16%. Very reasonable growth in market valuation. There's a lot of noise about the market being overvalued and you ought to be out of it or you ought to be into it or you should buy on the dip or whatever. Well, you know, what we've got is a market that's been doing the same thing for several months now, at least two quarters, and that is it has recovered to its long-term mean trend line, the S&P 500, and it is rising because the earnings, the profitability of the companies in the index are rising, and it's pretty much in lockstep with it. Now, I got ahead of it a little bit, and that's why we had a correction. Well, we had a correction for another reason, too.
Yeah, we can get into that a little bit. I want to throw this out there because earnings for the fourth quarter, while it's before the finalization of the tax changes take effect in 2018 for 2018. So people that are filing their taxes today are doing it for last year. It's the old tax law. Same's not quite true for corporations. They still have to file for last year on the old law, but the assets that they're carrying on the books now fall under the new law. So I'm going to say something that's a little bit ironic, more than a little bit ironic. Fannie Mae is asking the U.S. Treasury for $3.7 billion with a B dollars.
Ah, peanuts.
They're still under conservatorship from the collapse of the house loan market in the Great Recession. They have not pulled back out of that. They've had quarters of profitability and they've had quarters of loss. What you'll notice is that companies that have had losses for a year are having these really weird charges that they say are cutting into their profitability. So Fannie Mae has just asked for $3.7 billion from the U.S. Treasury. Now, you're going to have to follow along here. I promise that this is funny. But you have to understand each of the pieces and how they add together before it's funny. Or if you're fiscally conservative, it just makes us all want to cry in a funny, what, that's reality type way. Okay, so Fannie Mae has a big asset that it's holding on its books. It's not a real asset. It doesn't actually exist as something in the real world. It's a fig tree in our amalgamation, if you will, a figment of our imagination. This large piece, this large asset was worth a lot of money. Well, what is this asset? This asset that they've had to write down. This is the thing. It's a depreciated asset that they had to write down. It caused a 6.5 billion dollar loss to the company. Well, what could cause a loss out of nowhere from just a tax change? This is lowering the taxes. What is this? Well, this asset that doesn't exist that caused this huge loss is their ability to take a loss that they had in the past and discount today's taxes with it. So Fannie Mae was bleeding money for a while. It was losing money hand over fist. Well, you don't owe taxes when you're losing money. If you don't have income, you don't owe taxes. But if you lose enough money, you can use those losses the next year to say, hey, I had those last losses last year. Well, in this case, the losses took place in a year with a higher tax bracket. The top tax bracket for corporations was much higher. It's now 21%. At the top, it used to be 36%. So all the losses that they're carrying on their books as a get-out-of-jail-free card type situation for not having to pay the U.S. Treasury money now become worth less money. So the loss here is that they have to pay the U.S. Treasury about $6.5 billion, which is fantastic because that put them into a loss situation where they lost about $3.7 billion on the books, and they need that money. So they went to their conservatorship, the U.S. Treasury, and said, I need $3.7 billion. So I guess the net to the Treasury was still positive. I mean, they...
there's another aspect of that in that the...
I just wish that I could do that if I had taxes. You write me a check first, then I'll write you a check.
The new tax law killed the loss carry forward.
No, it didn't.
It was in one of the drafts.
In multiple drafts it was, but it did not kill it.
Oh, okay.
It's still there. And that's one of the things. The new law, many of the drafts look better than the law that we have now in that it got rid of this carryover indefinitely. I had a loss 10 years ago, so I'm going to put it against today's taxes, which doesn't make any sense if you really think about it. There's an asset that you hold on the books. That is based, it's basically like a carbon credit, if you think about it that way. It doesn't really exist. I had a loss before. That loss is worth something to me in the future against taxes. Okay, that's a really hard one to wrap your mind around for a second. If you have this asset that you basically think of it as a bunch of credits that you have stacked up that you can use against future taxes, but suddenly those credits become worth less. Well, where are those credits held? It's not in an account. It's not anywhere except on paper for taxes. It doesn't actually exist. It's one of the inefficiencies in the tax code. They have a big asset that caused an immediate loss to the company. The asset was a loss. So the loss caused the loss because the loss wasn't worth as much as it used to be. And the fact that they could then turn around to the U.S. Treasury and say, here, have a check and you write me one too. All I got to say about that is, man, that'd be nice for everybody, wouldn't it?
Well, when you got a company that is, in essence, at this point, primarily owned and controlled by the federal government,
yeah,
and its profitability is restricted.
Uh-huh.
Then I think it's pretty reasonable to say if you won't let us make a profit without your permission, you won't let us do anything without your permission, then when things screw up, it's your fault and you got to pay for it.
Well, reasonable kind of goes out the window when the government is running a company.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the basic underlying factor here is that if the government's running a company and it doesn't make a profit because the government changed the tax code, but then it has to pay the government, but the government pays it back. That shouldn't be strange or weird, but it is. I look at it and it just doesn't, it makes my mind do weird conniptions and a little bit of froth comes out my mouth and my ears and I go, what? So it's basically imaginary money being paid to the IRS and imaginary money value for things that you could never sell to anyone.
Well, but you can. You can sell it.
You can't sell your loss carryover.
You can use it. No. Actually, companies, and this is something I remember, at least under the old tax law, it was pretty easy. A company would buy another company, and part of what they would get when they bought the company was the tax losses that the company was still carrying on the book that they could apply against their existing. So you could literally –
You can buy a company that's had a lot of losses.
But its asset, one of its assets was a tax write-off. And so that's one of the companies that were otherwise not worth a lot because they were losing money.
Right.
Would be bought by other companies.
Just like a carbon credit.
Just to get the.
This is exactly what happens in Europe right now. If there's a company that is losing money hand over fist, but it's got lots of carbon credits, a profitable company will go and buy it for more than it should ever be worth because it has this imaginary thing in it.
But you got to buy carbon credits.
They're allocated in Europe.
They're allocated?
They're allocated by factory, by size, by a lot of things. You can also buy them. You can trade them with other companies.
Hmm.
But if a company has a big store of carbon credits because they've been ignoring it because they've been losing all their money and laying off their employees, but they still have all these carbon credits, somebody can come and buy that company. But you can't buy just the loss. You can buy the company with the loss. There's an idea. Warren Buffett should buy Fannie Mae just for its losses, except that he would never do that because –
No, he likes to buy profitable companies.
Yeah, profitability is a lot better than lossability, even if you get a tax benefit for it.
The number I gave you earlier, 80-some sacks, actually it's 78%. In the S&P 500, 349 companies have reported, and 78% have come in above expectations. That's normally 62%, so that's still quite impressive.
A lot of earnings coming in,
and that's
exciting.
And the guidance from those companies is pretty consistent too. Almost universally, as these companies report in and have relatively high earnings from last quarter, they are also saying everything we see in activity going on in January suggests that this next quarter will be as good or better, which is going to be kind of interesting. We missed the major blizzard this year so far. So we could see some unusually high GDP numbers come in for the first quarter. Normally the first quarter kind of sucks,
yeah,
to say the least.
It get because a big blizzard hits in the Northeast, and then everything slows down. It's probably going to be pretty good this quarter.
So by the way, the Commerce Department, this is what's fascinating to me.
But sometimes it happens in March. So
when they did the they do the seasonal adjustment, and after 3 years –
they're changing their seasonal adjustments for the first quarter.
Yeah, what they did is they said, okay, obviously we need to amp up the seasonal adjustment and make it raise the numbers in the first quarter because it's unrealistic that they're always low in the first quarter. And I think they made the change last year, so this year we'll probably have a good first quarter and it gets amped up. But expect to see a really good number come out of the first quarter.
And let me throw.
And the politicians will probably jump in there and take credit for it, but don't give them that much credit.
There are some specific areas of the economy that are not doing well. Specific groups of companies. Gun manufacturers are not doing well.
Well, that's because there's a Republican as president.
That's correct. It's like reverse psychology here. When a Democrat is in the Oval Office, everybody thinks the guns are going to be regulated and they're going to not be able to buy the guns, or somebody's going to ban something or another. So people go out and buy guns like crazy because they think they're not going to be able to buy them next year, or maybe even later this year. So a Republican in the Oval Office, which sounds like it'd be a fantastic thing for guns, is horrible for the gun companies because people aren't scared that Donald Trump is going to take their guns away. So people don't buy 10 guns at a time. They only buy one gun at a time.
There's also some relatively interesting things, at least to us geeks, going on in the economy. One of which is the price of oil has been rising recently. And despite the fact that in the United States we're producing oil and we're accelerating in our production of oil, as a matter of fact, we aren't there yet, being the largest oil producers in the world. But if we just keep on drilling holes,
it should be right around June.
Right. Sometime this year, we will be the largest. We'll pass Russia as the largest oil producer in the world.
Right. And it may even be April because there are a lot of companies getting into it right now.
And when it comes to oil exports, we're about to get a boost. The estimate now is early 2019, which isn't that far away. One of the problems we run into is most of our oil funnels down to refineries on the Gulf Coast.
Yeah.
And the Gulf Coast doesn't have any deep water ports. And we say, well, you know, Houston's got a pretty good port. But a super tanker cannot dock anywhere along the Gulf Coast.
Yeah. They have to go out to sea anchor or come up to a filling facility, well, which is out in the water, way out there. It's not very efficient.
We're building our first deep water superport off the Louisiana coast, and its first tanker is filling up right now. It's a test to make sure it works right. They have to have the ability to make this loop and have a traffic pattern for the tankers, and it's a lot more complicated than it sounds, and then run the oil offshore and pump it into the tankers. But once we get to where we can efficiently start running a stream of super tankers through this deep water offshore port in the Gulf of Mexico, our ability to export oil will go up rather dramatically, and it should cause a drop in the price of world oil.
At the same time that the dollar's falling, so...
Well, that's what I was going to get into. The reason the price of oil is going up is not because it's going up necessarily in the world. It's because the dollar's falling.
Right.
Same reason that if you follow the price of gold...
It's way up, too.
$1,350, and it's rising slowly. But if you look at the way it rises and you look at the price of... You look at the dollar value, you realize gold isn't rising. The dollar's falling.
Right. If you look in euros, the gold prices haven't changed very much at all. But if you look in dollars, it definitely has gone up.
So we got a dollar value, and this is one of those conundrums that Jake and I dig into and have entirely too much fun digging around with. The dollar, normally the interest rates cause money flows inward. So in the United States, we have the government, our government treasury bonds, bills, and notes have a higher interest rate than they do, for instance, in Germany, which is also considered to be a very stable place to put your money. And the German just now, for the two-year note in Germany, are just now coming out of the negative range. So you would think that we would, and we did early in 2017, get this huge inflow of money into the United States, and it had been going on for some time, but it accelerated because we had higher interest rates. So you could get a higher interest rate on a secure piece of government bond or whatever. And so the dollar kept going up and kept going up, and that was really cool. It started down to the point where from last year it's down about 8-point-something% compared with a basket of currencies. If you recall, at the beginning of last year, the euro, for example, was almost on parity with the dollar at the beginning of 2017.
Yeah, it was very, very close.
It costs about $1.25 now to buy 1 euro. Well, what's going on? Well, the other thing that should factor in here, logically, if we follow our assumptions, which is a bad idea, the tax law dramatically encouraged companies that are holding large liquid positions overseas to bring them home because they've already paid taxes on this thing, bring them home for free.
I think it didn't encourage. This is the weird thing. It unencouraged.
Okay, but this is the point.
That's the weird thing is that they were not – they were discouraged from being at – from bringing it back before, and they undiscouraged them, but they didn't encourage them.
Well, this is a critical point, because if you recall, and I know memories don't go that long, if you recall a month ago, one of the big arguments to pass the new tax bill that dramatically cut corporate tax rates was it would cause them to bring their money home. But the point is, they are not bringing it home.
Right. Here's the reason. Can I throw this in there so that you can continue? The idea here is that let's just do it in a very completely un-PC way. If there's a dog that keeps coming into your yard, and every time it comes into your yard, you hit it with a stick, so it doesn't come into your yard anymore.
Your neighbors are going to call the.
Yeah, it's very un-PC. So you're hitting this dog with a stick, and then you make a household decision. We are no longer going to hit this dog with a stick when it comes into our yard. You can't call that change encouraging the dog to come into your yard just because you're not going to hit it anymore.
But here's my point. And I don't know, I can't personally attest to the numbers, but I see it in several different places, and I've seen it in some fairly well-researched places. There's about $11 trillion of liquid assets held by U.S.-based corporations overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say liquid assets, that means they could be brought home fairly easily. It's not like they have real estate they have to sell or factories or something.
They're one-year type bonds. They're, CD type purchases, only much larger. Yeah.
I'm not talking about cash. That's generally considered cash. What I'm saying is it's over there, but the vast majority of it is in bonds. But this is my point. If that money was coming back to the United States as a result of the tax law changes, which keeps getting reported, it's going to come back. Apple's going to bring their money back, and Google's going to bring their money back, and here's what they're going to do with it. I keep reading about this. If we took $11 trillion that was in somewhere else in the world, doesn't make any difference where it is, and it came back to the United, converted to, it isn't in dollars, it's in euros or renminbi, or it's in something that's not a dollar. If you brought it back and if you purchased $11 trillion worth of dollars, the dollar would rise in value dramatically.
Which would cause all of the prices of the companies that are trying to bring the money back to go way up overseas, which would mean nobody would want to buy them.
And when you consider that that money is sitting over there invested mainly in bonds, would cause the bond market, wherever they sold all those bonds to convert them to dollars, to crash. So the argument that we needed to cut corporate taxes to get them to bring their money home apparently isn't working very well. Now, Apple is talking about bringing some money back, but they also have discussed in their most recent meeting that they're not going to rush to do so, and there won't be any one-time big dividend that some Apple shareholders were arguing for. With good cause, there won't be a single one-time dividend. The reason is they got to sell out of a lot of bonds, and interest rates are going up, which means in many cases they bought those bonds with the intention, bonds or notes or bills, with the intention of holding them to maturity so they wouldn't lose money on them.
Right. Then let's be clear here, because the majority of this $11 trillion that we're talking about, you're saying bonds, but it's a category, and that's what I was talking about, CD-type thing. It's not a CD. They're in longer term than a normal bank account. So they're in a short-term note or a bill position, which is really what a CD is that you get some penalties if you pull out too soon.
Or in this case, you get a market penalty, double whammy market penalty if you back out too soon, and it would have to show up as – it would, by the way, show up as a loss on their earnings reports if they sold for less than they paid for.
Right. So they are still not encouraged to bring the money home. They're just not disencouraged to bring the money home. And the encouragement is supposed to be the wonder of the innovation in the United States, because we are still the innovative leaders of the world.
Mm-hmm. But here's the problem with that. One of the main reasons that the dollar is falling, at least in my opinion, as I look at the cash flows and look at what's going on, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what is it, this week, sometime in the immediate future, is actually going to go into effect without us.
It happened, I think, last week.
The Europeans are setting up trade deals with South America and with the Pacific Rim. There's trade deals popping up all over the world, the equivalent of the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership. This is seen by major institutional investors as healthy, because it produces more trade. More trade produces more money, produces more GDP, which causes everybody, but the average standard of living at least to rise within a country, whereas the United States is making noises about moving in the other direction. We have decided not to be part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which means that we'll still pay tariffs to get in and out of countries that other countries won't have to pay. Our intellectual property rights that were going to be protected under TPP don't get protected now.
Right.
The other thing that's going on in the big wide world out there with the trade issue is we are threatening to pull out of NAFTA, which would be disastrous for the economy, and major investors recognize that. And Jake has more detail on this, and I'm interested in hearing your story on this. The Commerce Department just said, hey, let's put a 48% tariff on steel and aluminum. Let's start a trade war.
Right. So those two items. Well, let me hit NAFTA first, because we're going to do a premise. The premise is NAFTA is bad. Now, anybody that listens to us for very long knows that's not what we think of NAFTA. But we're going to assume that the people that are anti-NAFTA are correct for a moment. Let's just use that assumption. NAFTA is bad. Let's get rid of NAFTA. We don't agree with that, but this is the premise.
A giant sucking sound.
Right. Yeah, as in the words of Ross Perot. Okay, so NAFTA is bad. This is the premise. If we scrap NAFTA and just say it's over with, even if it's bad, it's going to cause an earning hit to American corporations across the board that may put many corporations into bankruptcy. Because based on NAFTA, they have purchased land in Mexico and in Canada. They have put huge amounts of money into manufacturing facilities that are not in the United States. So you might say, well, that's why NAFTA is bad, because they'd put it there instead of here. It's kind of a free market system. Labor was cheaper in certain places. They put them there. Then we've got stuff in Alabama and Texas and so on. Those facilities, if NAFTA is scrapped, suddenly become completely unprofitable. Loss of money in every direction. So they have to basically write off all of the money that they put into that facility and start over with higher labor costs here. So it doesn't usually work that way. Most companies don't say when they have lots of cash on hand, hey, let's close down that over there. It's profitable, but maybe it won't be in the future. We'll just make a new one over here. So it would only happen after NAFTA got scrapped that the building process would begin, and hopefully most of the companies don't go bankrupt in the process.
There's lots of problems with it, but one of the problems, and it is a major problem, is the reason that Ford and General Motors and Chrysler, to give three examples, the big three in the United States, have competitive prices when compared with, let's say, a Japanese or a Korean car.
I think it's Fiat Chrysler, just a side note.
Okay, right. Well, we're talking about companies we traditionally think of as U.S.-based. Okay,
all right.
One of the reasons they're able to stay competitive with Japanese and Korean companies – by the way, the Japanese companies don't make their cars in Japan. At least not much of their car in Japan – is because we're able to do a lot of the assembly work, which is monotonous – assembly line work in Mexico. It's just a simple fact. And because of NAFTA, we can move the parts across the border, have them put together in Mexico, and the completed car comes back to the United States or Canada. They're actually putting them together in Canada now too.
I've mentioned this in the past. I bought an American car, a Ford, and it was built in Canada.
So the issue is if NAFTA goes away, let's say we scrap NAFTA, or let's say we make major adjustments and as a result we start paying tariffs on cars. By the way, that's
American cars.
That's probably one of the big points is unless the car is a lot more, quote, American made, end quote, we'll pay a tariff on it when we bring it back into the United States. Even though the price of American cars to remain profitable, and I've seen different estimates on this, will need to rise between 10 and 20%. So if you've got an American car sitting here and there's a Lexus and a General Motors luxury car sitting side by side in your mind.
And a BMW for that matter.
And so you look at these vehicles and you realize that the American car costs 10 to 20% more than the one that theoretically is a Japanese car or theoretically is a German car. You're not probably going to buy the American car, which is going to cause the American automobile makers to produce fewer cars because they're not going to sell as many.
Right. They're going to have to shut down plants in Canada and Mexico. So at the same time that their sales are going down, they're going to have to do big capital expenditures here.
Then we run into the next problem, and that is everything in economics. All the economists and everybody is doing surveys, including the Labor Department, the Commerce Department, Zandi, everybody who's looking at this is saying we are hitting a wall on labor. We don't have enough people. For example, in the automobile industry, we don't have enough people to properly run. They can't expand their factories in the United States because they can't find anybody to hire. So this is – why are we carrying on and on about this? Is this something political? No. It is simply – why is the dollar going down if we have higher interest rates, which normally attract money,
right.
And we just changed our tax laws to allow corporations to bring money back to the United States, which means they should be buying dollars.
The dollar's going down
but
because
the dollar's
we're, stuck,
down, almost 10%.
Yeah, we're stepping back from the trade world. We're saying we're not going to compete, and we have been the flag bearers of free trade. As soon as we get some competition, we say, nope, we're going home. Sorry. And that's a problem.
Very frankly, if we start a trade war with China,
it will be good for China long term.
It
won't be good for either of us short term.
It's not going to be a good thing in the United States, and we've got commercials to play.
Yes, we do. And we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join in our conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And we are capable of saying our name in a coordinated fashion. Are we
sometimes
there? Are we there yet?
Sometimes.
I think we're here.
We're here.
Are we here yet? Okay. Anyway, telephone number in here is 254-773-1400, which shows that I don't have Alzheimer's too badly anyway.
Well, we hope not.
What did I just say?
I don't know. What were we talking about?
I don't know. Anyway, but we're talking about, what were you just talking about? See, I can remember. That's cool.
Yeah.
We're talking about the fact that the dollar has been falling. Now, what?
We wanted to hit the second part of your statement, too. You talked about NAFTA, but then about these new tariffs.
Right. Talk about the tariffs. And then I got something else I want to talk about.
Okay. The Commerce Department just recommended that the president put some pretty severe tariffs on steel and aluminum.
Aluminium,
depending on
outside the United States, it's aluminium, but when it's inside the United States, aluminum.
Yeah, so it's an accent on location. So as it's in the United States, it's aluminum. So it's really, it should be a tariff on aluminium because it's outside the United States.
Locative,
right?
Accent.
The idea is that there's just not a whole lot of steel and aluminum being made in the United States. And China, for one, is making a lot of steel and a lot of aluminum, and they're being subsidized through tax incentives by the Chinese government. Now, we do the same thing, and we have done for many, many years. We give tax breaks for certain corporations, certain types of industry, like oil, gas, that sort of thing. So it's not an even playing field in any industry. Keep that in mind. Let me explain what happened with the steel, the powerhouse of America in steel. You know, it's kind of like it used to be with oil. Oil and steel were American. They're just, you know, as American as oil and steel or apple pie. It was a big American
U.S. steel.
U.S. steel.
Right.
I mean, we broke it up. It was the basically the only steel made anywhere in the world was owned by Americans. And what happened is that technology shifted and we didn't. The mini mill came in, but the big steel companies had so much money in their steel production plants that it would cost more when they consider the sunk cost of their big facility to start these little mini mills, and now they're at micro mills, that can be done in much smaller facilities for less money. Lots less money. The big, big, big facilities. We've all seen the videos of these huge, massive, we're going to use non-technical layperson terms, big buckets of molten steel being poured out. I grew up with the PSAs about American steel and all that good stuff. Well, it's just not as profitable to do it that way anymore. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. I wanted to go into some more detail on the technology shifts, but let's take the caller first. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Oh, didn't want to be on the air.
Obviously. They just wanted to listen on the phone.
Yeah, that's a...
let's back up. There's a very good reason that steel and aluminum coming out of China is cheap. The Chinese built a lot of big steel and aluminum factories to create the steel and aluminum needed to modernize the country. Well, as the modernization is getting complete, they still have the capacity, and they don't want to lay off all those people.
It's kind of the same reason that America became big in steel, is that when we were growing in the industry world in the early 1900s, in the early 20th century, we had huge demand. We were building lots of bridges, lots of roads, lots of buildings. It was the steel age. And so we built facilities to meet that demand. Over time, the demand has slackened a bit. We're not building bridges the way we used to. We're not building, you know, when was the last time you heard about a massive bridge being built in the United States? And the answer to that is a long time ago. They're building massive bridges in China. So the government is subsidizing the steel on that end. Now, that's not fair. So let's get that out in the open. Another aspect, though, is that the type of manufacturing that they're doing there is based on scrap iron and scrap steel. So these little arc furnaces, little being compared to the massive furnaces that we had in the old U.S. steel plants, these little arc furnaces were much less expensive to run. And when they first came out, they couldn't do high-quality steel. So they started producing rebar. And the big American steel companies didn't want to compete on rebar. There's not a lot of margin there. So they just moved up to the next layer above it, the one that has a higher margin, some sheet steel. We'll do sheet steel. They can have rebar. We don't want to do rebar anyway. We don't make any money on that. That's the lowest profitability we've got. We don't want to touch it. Well, as the mini mills got better and the arc furnaces got better and they could do a little bit of extra refining with the scrap metal as it went through the furnace, they got to do sheet steel, which moved angle iron in as the next profitability. And this is a classic disruption model. If you think about Toyota, when they first started taking cars to the United States, there were jokes about Japanese cars breaking. They were tiny little shoeboxes that you drove around in, and if you sneezed at it, it would fall apart. Well, the American companies didn't compete at that level. They didn't try to make little cheap cars. Well, they did at the beginning, and they just did 1 year of it and said, it's not profitable anyway. We don't want to get our name associated with those dinky little things. So they moved on up to the next layer, to the mid-level cars, and they said, this is profitable. We'll do that. Until Toyota got good enough and profitable enough making dinky little cars that fell apart, that they could make mid-level cars that didn't fall apart. That they worked really hard at fixing their dinky little cars that fell apart until they were really good at making quality, cheap cars. And then they moved up into the mid-level. And the American cars said, oh, well, we'll just go up into SUVs and higher-level expensive cars. It's more profitable there anyway. Well, now Toyota is eating our lunch. That's what disruption is. It's a classic disruption model. New technology comes on the scene, or new innovator comes on the scene. If you're on the top, it means that everybody can knock you down eventually. We were on top of the steel market, and you don't get back on top by putting extra charges on other people's stuff. You get back on top by starting back at the bottom. Get as profitable as you can on the little stuff, because it is more profitable to do rebar with a micro mill. So it's gone from mini mills to micro mills. With a micro mill, you can create rebar in the United States that knocks the price out of the, just completely down into the basement compared to Chinese rebar. But American companies aren't doing it because we've gotten out of the steel business because we feel like it's not profitable. And we need to do the same disruption model to them as they did to us, but instead we're going to slap a tariff on them.
There's a fact in the world. Making steel in the world today is not profitable. There is just too many people making steel.
Right.
And let's just say that we throw a tariff. To give you an example of why this doesn't work, and we figured this out
a long time ago,
and we're having to relearn it again the hard way. You throw a tariff on steel, the 48% tariff. Okay, so steel then goes up by roughly 50%. So what used to cost $1,000 cost $1,500 in the United States. But if you go outside the United States, you can buy the same steel for $1,000.
Well, it just means you go outside the United States to do whatever you're going to do with steel.
Which means that the places in the United States where they still make ships, they'll stop making ships because they'll make them someplace else because the steel's cheaper.
Right. The assumption is that people aren't going to change their location. It's kind of like a tobacco tax. If you've got a little city or a little state and they put a big high tobacco tax on there, what it does is it exactly does what they think it's going to do. It's going to cause a lot less tobacco sales in that location. But it causes all the areas around that location to have their tobacco sales go up. The same thing happens when you throw a tariff on anything.
Let me give you another example. Let's just say that 10% – and I don't know this is at all true. This is purely hypothetical. 10% of the price of a car that you pay $20,000 for is steel. Well, if steel goes up 50% in price because we put a tariff on it and the steel makers suddenly become profitable, whereas they're marginal right now, and we get a 50% jump, that means that 50% of that 10%, or that means the price of cars in the United States goes up 5%. Now, you don't get any more car. Just the price of the car went up 5%. Well, now the car that is made in Japan, where the steel is $1,000 instead of $1,500, is now less expensive than the car that's made in the United States, which means we either have to – I mean, it becomes it's a big thing with lots of moving parts.
Right. Let me hit the other rhyme in history. In the 1980s was the last time we talked about steel tariffs. And we were not talking about China at that point. We were talking about Japan.
Japan, yes.
Because Japanese steel was taking over the world because they had to rebuild after World War II.
But then we got Iron Man.
Yeah, and Iron Man went over. No, they had to rebuild. They had to rebuild a lot of bridges. They were building a lot of buildings. They were bringing their technology and their infrastructure, which had pretty well been flattened,
so we need
into
somebody.
The 20th century.
Do we need somebody to bomb us into the Stone Age and then we can then...
No, I think the least efficient way
well,
of doing it.
It's one way of doing it. I mean,
you do have to get rid of the dead wood though. And we have to get rid of the unprofitable, way too large steel manufacturing processes.
You know,
it's not competitive anymore. And the people that set it up, the original people that created these steel manufacturing facilities would be rolling in their graves. They would be squirming to see that we're hanging on to those when they're not profitable instead of creating new things that are.
If you want it, and this is not to say that we need to, and there's a risk here. There's a risk that we could put our steel and aluminum manufacturing industry out of business.
By doing this, yeah.
No. By doing nothing, if the Chinese were to continue to
subsidize, yeah.
They are going to subsidize. And if they continue to sell steel and aluminum to the United States, to people in the United States at a price two-thirds of that of what it costs to make it here,
right?
Then eventually our steel and aluminum manufacturers go out of business and on national – and I concur with the Trump administration on this in that they say it is a threat to national security.
Yeah,
that's their reasoning.
We've
okay?
got to have steel and aluminum manufacturing.
Here's the solution, and it's one that is anathema to a lot of people, but it's very simple. The Chinese are, in effect, subsidizing the steel and aluminum industry. Okay. Give the steel and aluminum industry a big tax break, just like the Chinese do, like we do for a lot of it. We do it for sugar. We do it for agriculture. You know, we basically pay people in agriculture not to grow crops.
Exactly.
But we could do the same thing with the steel and aluminum industry. We could, and believe me, the money would, if we said steel and aluminum, guess what? We are going to say you are, in effect, nonprofit organizations, and we're going to give you a special tax exemption. Investment money would flow from all over the world into the United States steel and aluminum industry, and we would suddenly find innovative, new, super profitable plants popping up everywhere, and we don't start a trade war. Now, the Chinese could file a complaint with the World Trade Organization, say you're subsidizing, and we just look back and say, yeah, you are too, and we're doing it exactly the same way you're doing it. So you don't have any leg to stand on.
Right.
We're doing it for national security.
The way we're doing it with a tariff is a lot less efficient because tariffs do not cause companies that are not profitable to get profitable. It sounds like they would. If you say, okay, your competitor is charging too little for this, we're going to put an extra charge on what they do. What it does is it causes the local companies to charge more too, which just causes the cost of everything with that component in it to go up. That is inflation.
Unless it's built outside the United States.
Unless it's built outside of the United States. So there's a tariff on steel. Is there a tariff on things that are made out of steel? No. So people just make them and then bring them in. And then we eventually have to tariff everything.
And then we get in a position where people don't do business with us because we're too expensive.
That's where we were with Japan for forever. We said, why don't you open your borders to free trade? Why don't you compete on an even playing field? Why do you keep slapping tariffs on everything that we're doing? We're getting into the same mentality. If we can't compete, we should take our toys home and stop trying. But I'll agree with Trump on this too. America first. We are the most competitive, most profitable place, most innovative place. Until we start giving everybody else handicaps to compete against us so that we aren't competing on an even playing field, we're not the hungriest. We're not the savviest because we don't have to be because we've discounted everything that we're doing.
To give you an example of why we're almost out of time for this hour, but this type of national level protectivism doesn't work. Try to find a ship that's registered in the United States.
Yeah.
Try to find a ship that's made in the United States. Well, what happened
the U.S. Navy ships are all registered in the United States.
But happened is over the years, Congress and presidents have passed bills and enacted tariffs and whatever is necessary to protect the shipbuilding industry in the United States, and as a result, ships are just generally not built in the United States anymore. Because the point is, it's a global world, whether we like it or not. And because it's a global world, and the biggest growth in the world is going on in the developing countries, not in the United States, and that's where the big demand is. It's, by the way, the people who buy the heavy equipment from us. You can't live alone. Anyway, we're about out of time for this hour.
Yeah. If you would like to contact us off the air, we actually give investment advice as fiduciary advice in the best interest of the client for people with high net worth. The phone number to call locally is
254-947. Now, this one's hard. 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free. There's voicemail during the weekend and real-life people during the week at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. We've got podcasts of all of the episodes going back to 2013. We've got copies of our newsletter. If you'd like to be on the newsletter list, let us know.
Stay tuned for next hour because I got some shocking news that should make all the conservatives' hair stand up if they have
any. Uh-oh. So we'll be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM, AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM. More.